House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development, Wednesday, April 25th, 8 a.m. here in New York City, public hearing and possible work session in the House, Joint Measure 12, work session in House Bill 3066, House Bill 3181, House Bill 2981, House Bill 2618.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the April 25th, 2007 session of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development. We are in order. And our first item on today's schedule is a public hearing on House Joint Memorial Number 12, and we have Senator Nelson. Good morning.
Yes, thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29. I'm here in support of House Joint Memorial 12. I'd like to just make a couple points on this. You might check the truth of this, but it's in the committees I've been sitting in, our ability to fund public services has been on a decline since 1991. You can also say that the decline in use of federal forests started in about 1991 or the late 80s and early 90s. So it's always been my thought that there's a correlation between our ability to fund public services, education, healthcare, public safety, is strictly correlated to the fact that we have not been using the amount of timber out of our federal forests that we could in a sustainable manner. I realize we have to do that. The second point I'd like to make is when I first ran for office in 1996, the pristine county of Wallowa was kind of my bellwether mark. At that time, we had three mills, three shifts. In the little small school district of Enterprise, they had about 640 students. Today, they have one mill and one shift, and their school population is about 375. So is there a correlation there? I believe there is. That's something your folks are going to have to make your mind whether it truly is. I think the thing that brought Oregon to the dance as far as being a state able to fund its public services has been its natural resources. And I'm absolutely shameless because I think federal forests are one. I think the Columbia River is another area that we've got to look forward to try and use some of that water in order to help fund our public services. I think what this Joint Memorial is all about is how do we position Oregon so we're going to be more successful. In the last session, Senate Bill 1072 was our effort, I think, as a legislature to create atmosphere so that we could get back and encourage the federal government to allow us to get back into our forest, into the federal forest. The hangar that we've been seeing, and there was a task force that met all during the interim with several members from all segments, all special interests, and how to resolve that problem. And the one thing that they really found out that there was kind of just holding everything up was the fact that the federal government was reluctant to enter into long-term contracts. And so that is the purpose of this memorial, is to say, federal government, we have an issue out here, to give them notice. With that, Mr. Chair, I would be more than happy to answer any questions, or maybe you want to talk with the folks who actually know something about this issue.
Thank you very, very much, Senator Nelson. Questions or comments by the committee members?
Just one small
thing. Yes, Vice Chair Lynn, please.
So this might not directly unrelated, but you mentioned there were 600-some plus students at the time, and after its closure, it's about 300-something. Where are the rest of the students gone? Have the family moved out?
Or they happened? Moved to Gresham in Portland.
Okay.
Wallowa County is basically now a retired person's town. They have a lot of folks coming in from California. The population has stayed about the same, but the young families have moved out, and so you just don't have the young families there anymore.
Yes, I'd just like to make a brief comment. I have a depressed timber district, and so I have cities that have been in decline as well, so I very much empathize with what you're saying.
Thank you.
Certainly appreciate your support of the Memorial Center.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Bill Clooney.
Chair Witt, committee, it's an honor and a privilege to be able to bring this memorial to the forefront. For the record, Bill Clinton, Carpenters Industrial Council. I want to thank all of you personally for signing on to this. It created quite a bit of interest in both halls. Oregon has a gigantic toolbox. You've heard that term, toolbox. And somehow the lid's been kept pretty tight on this toolbox. And this is one of the keys to open this lid, especially to help our rural areas. And with the bad news about the ONC funding we keep hearing, and today's paper was even worse news, this is a jump start for these rural folks that have been decimated by the lack of proper management in our federal force. This is an opportunity for Oregon to step forward with the Department of Forestry, working with the federal folks. We can move this plan forward. We can create hundreds and hundreds of jobs. Now, we're not talking about all the federal forests. We're just talking about the 4.5 million acres that man has logged since we came west. We're not talking about roadless areas, although I would like to talk about roadless areas, but or wilderness areas. So it's basically hands off. But we have an opportunity here to step into these forests, carefully work the land. We can create many cogeneration plants or plants to produce biofuels. But each one of these plants is a key to creating 50 to 60 to 70 jobs on each site. These are year-round jobs. With the federal monies, the state monies, I know these plants are very expensive. This is why the long-term programs, the federal government knows, whoever's in control of Washington, D.C., they know they have a problem. And this is Oregon's chance to step forward. Hopefully, this thing can get moving fast, because these counties, these rural counties, is going to need this assistance as quickly as possible. Again, I want to thank you for signing on to this, and I'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill. I know you thanked us for signing on. Did you miss anybody here in the legislature signing on to this thing?
There was a couple folks home, and there's just a couple folks you just can't get to sometimes, but they have stepped forward and said, gee, I wish you had caught me.
That's a rather extensive list. Good job here. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I simply wanted to note the compromise language in your presentation, and also to say that I believe that's the way in which you get half a loaf rather than none from your point of view, and do proper forest management and create jobs from my point of view. I think you get everybody on board that way, and it works very well.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, and excuse me for this being ready, Bill. I think you've been everywhere. I think you've done everything that possibly can be done to bring logs. With this morning's news, Representative Barnhart and I were in a meeting. We're going to need logs. My question is, should we send a joint house memorial to the state land board and ask them to cut some logs on the Elliott? Would that be an appropriate memorial, too?
That's a very good question, Chair Witt. Representative Dolan, yes, I'll start packing it around. If you, we can sit down and work out some language. I feel that we could very easily increase the cut in our state forest. It's especially the Elliott, where that's directed to schools only, and myself, I do feel that we could almost double the cut in the Elliott Forest and still maintain our sustainable yield and still keep care of our habitat for wildlife, fishes, I feel that there is room for more cutting in our state forest.
Thank you, Bill. I've worked with and Mr. Cruding a lot, and I will be supporting this bill.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask David Mormon to come up, please.
Good morning. Vice Chair Riley, members of the committee. My name is David Mormon. I'm the director of the Forest Resources Planning Program at the Oregon Department of Forestry. Also want to express our strong support for HGM 12. It's consistent with the sustainable forest management policies of the Board of Forestry, of which Representative Witt has firsthand knowledge of, and consistent with the recommendations of the Oregon Forest Biomass Work Group, which was referenced by Senator Nelson. The Biomass Work Group was formed by the Departments of Forestry and Energy to identify how to improve forest health by reducing forest fuel loadings and accelerate the use of forest woody biomass as a value-added commodity and energy supply. Among other topics that the work group report highlights is that the lack of a predictable supply of forest biomass material for energy generation and biofuels makes it difficult for the private sector to make investment decisions and for land managers to promote biomass utilization opportunities. Using existing authorities, federal land managers have the opportunity to address this issue, but they're currently underfunded and inexperienced with providing small diameter material biomass supply, and they haven't created consistent systems for a levelized supply of this material. The Forest Biomass Work Group has concluded that an insufficient number and extent of long-term stewardship contracts encompassing significant volumes of biomass material is a major obstacle to providing this predictable supply, and in turn an obstacle to increased private investment. Consistent with the direction from the 2005 legislature, which again Senator Nelson referenced, the Department of Forestry is actively working already with federal, state, and local partners to promote greater use of existing federal authority to enter into stewardship contracts to accomplish forest restoration, wildfire risk reduction, and small diameter forest biomass utilization. To be effective in accomplishing these objectives, it's important that the federal stewardship contracts be developed in a manner that addresses specific site-specific objectives on larger rather than smaller acreage scales, and through longer term rather than shorter term time frames for implementation. And we feel that prompt passage of this memorial will send a strong message to Congress that our federal partners on the importance and urgency of this issue to Oregon. And on the last point, I think I would reference something that Senator Nelson was talking about, kind of what's happening in rural Oregon. I think we're seeing the same thing in the Department of Forestry, that on our current track, rural Oregon becomes a place for the wealthy and the poor, but we really haven't figured out how we can create a rural Oregon that where the middle class can thrive. And I think opportunities like we have through this memorial give us a great chance to move forward on that issue. Thank you for the opportunity to address this topic, and look forward to working with the committee on it.
Thank you, Mr. Warmer. Any questions? Yes, Representative Dell.
Thank you for your testimony, and I don't want to stay on this subject too long, but taking your testimony, and I do have the written, could I apply those same comments to the Elliott?
Vice Chair Riley, Representative Allen, certainly you could. I think I don't represent the State Forest Program. I work in another branch of the department, but I think my answer to that is I think both the management on the Elliott and on our Tillamook State Forest, other state forests in Oregon, is exemplary already, so I'm a little bit biased in that regard. I do think the management that we're practicing there can be a model that federal land managers can follow, and I think rather than challenging the state forest model, I'd like to see it be used as an example, and the stakes are so much higher on federal lands that if we could, for example, get BLM lands, which are currently undergoing management plan revisions, to adopt some of the more active management strategies on we're already using on state forest land, the benefits could be much more significant.
The long and the short of it, we could set an example with the Elliott on sustainable forest and increased yield. Thank you.
Representative Lim.
Thank you. I'm not a scientist, but according to the background information given to me, and the biomass is considered small trees. And how small it could be. I don't see any clear definition of a small tree, you know, compared to real big ones. Every August could be a small tree. So what's the definition on it?
Vice Chair Riley, Representative Lim, I think anything that has merchantable value already is already being utilized as through timber sales and other contracts on public lands. This is material that has generally not been having any commercial value in the past. So we're talking very small material. It could just be a couple of inches, 6 inches in diameter or smaller, that type of material. It could be the tops of larger trees that might otherwise be left on site, creating a fuel load. It could be the thousands of acres of very densely stocked stands that we have that have very small trees that are growing very slowly, that are unnatural compared to what you would have normally seen those forests contain.
So just a follow-up question.
Follow-up, please.
In the early 90s, the state and the federal government we passed, it has been a great issue of the spotted owl. Do you believe of this HJM-12 has anything to do with circumventing of that the spotted owl issue?
Representative Lim, I think particularly in our, there's an interesting intersection between spotted owl habitat and some of our fire-prone forests. It's a different story if you're talking about the Coast Range, but if you're talking about the High Cascades or Southwest Oregon, I think it's a real challenge for land managers to manage long-term spotted owl habitat in an environment which is prone to catastrophic wildfire. And we saw that on the Biscuit Fire, where a significant number of areas set aside for spotted owl habitat were damaged by the fire. So I think more active management in some of those cases in the long run may be needed, not only to reduce fire hazard, to produce material for economic development, but also to maintain some of that habitat for endangered species that we're very interested in maintaining. I think that what we're learning as foresters and as scientists is how dynamic our forests are, and that a static management strategy doesn't really work when you have natural disturbances such as fire that enter into the equation.
Just to follow up.
Yes, please.
And concerning the fire issue, I'm not sure how big it's going to space between the federal land, the state land, whatever. And then sometimes the fact that there are a lot of trees in there prevents fire just occurring. When we are cutting up small shrubs between, that could catch fire, and a 10, 15, 20 miles an hour wind, it will just engulf the whole thing. And I'm not sure, unless you may continually maintain it somehow, otherwise I'm not sure whether it's going to work or not, even though I heard the last testimony that has been working in some other states.
Vice Chair Riley, Representative Lim, I think your point's a valid one. I think two points are very important to remember. When we're talking about managing forests, we need very site-specific prescriptions. And for some forest types where you have different natural fire regimes, natural fire return intervals, maybe you don't need to be doing this thinning. There are other stands, particularly in eastern Oregon, southwest Oregon, that naturally evolve with low-intensity, frequent fires. And because of fire suppression, we have unnatural overstocking, and serious levels of thinning and stocking reduction are needed in order to return those forests to a state in which they more naturally occurred, which were more open stands with very little undergrowth, some of the pine stands that you see in eastern Oregon. And I guess we'll just stop there. That was the main point.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you.
Forestry is a continually advancing area of study and endeavor, isn't it?
That's correct.
Your agency knows a lot more about the management of forests than we did when we replanted the Tillamook, for example, 70 years ago. Do you believe that it is, you described a dynamic management process in which you manage forests differently depending upon the location and perhaps even the purpose for which you're managing them. Do you believe that forestry is at the stage now where it's possible to maintain, if we put the effort into it and add the rules that allowed it, that the science of forestry could sustain healthy forests and also produce substantial employment and material from our forests?
Mr. Riley, Representative Barnhart, I think we can, and I think and encourage you again to look at the work the Board of Forestry has done on this topic. And again, Representative Witt served on the board during that time. In the Forestry Program for Oregon, the Board of Forestry has laid out, I think, a blueprint for forest management in Oregon that inject some humility into it that we don't necessarily always know, and we need to learn as we're managing, but also this notion that not all forests in Oregon need to be managed in the same way, that there is a role for reserve forests, for wood production forests, for multi-resource forests, for rural residential forests. And I think we have a lot of knowledge that we didn't have years ago on how to manage for those different purposes. And the real question and the thing that we tend to argue about a lot is how much of those different management emphases do we need and are they in the right locations? But I think the fact that we have those different management emphases all contribute to the environmental, economic, and social sustainability that we're striving for.
And I mean, for a couple more, if it were in the cards to do it, and if it actually happened, do you think that your agency could, over a reasonable period of time, tool up to actually manage, for example, some of the low elevation? Plantation lands that the Bureau of Land Management has essentially neglected for the last 30 years or so yourselves, if that were in the cards?
Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think certainly that's a topic that's been talked about off and on for many years, and I think we are a proactive agency and would obviously be interested in talking to people about that. I think in the long term, federal land management policies need to recognize, if not directly turning over management to the state, that there needs to be a greater recognition of regional sovereignty, however you want to put it, over land management on federal lands, in that there's a lot of regional interest in these lands, and I think somehow the model needs to be changed that we currently have, which is more of a national command and control model, which really stifles local decision-making, which is really how the Forest Service originally was established. So I think there are, if not direct state control, many things we can do to work together to improve that situation.
And then one final, if I may.
Please.
We had a very strong timber economy 30 years ago. I'll make up a number, maybe 40 years ago. We took a lot of timber out of off federal land. Is there any likelihood that we could return to that level of yield anytime soon, or if ever, and do it on a sustained basis?
Chair Witt, Representative Barnhart, it's a function of what other uses we want out of those forests. Certainly the potential to grow fiber is there and continues to be there. That hasn't diminished. And we're actually tracking that as contributing to an Oregon Progress Board benchmark, is looking at not only what are we harvesting off of our public lands, but how does that compare to current management plans, and then how does that compare to the potential to grow fiber, so that people can see how much of that opportunity we have foregone in order to meet other social and environmental needs that we're seeking. So I think the potential is there. Realistically, I don't see us returning to the 4 billion board feet per year we were harvesting off federal lands. I think I'd encourage you to look at some information the Oregon Forest Resources Institute has produced, which has shown the federal lands in Oregon would be very capable of producing, say, 1 billion board feet per year, and that would have dramatic positive effects on the Oregon economy. And I think would be maybe a healthy compromise from where we were in the past.
It certainly would. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Barnhart. Anyone else? Not seeing any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Joint Memorial 12 today? I'm not seeing anyone. Committee members, we are all signed on to the memorial. Would you like to work this bill, a memorial today?
Sure, please. Let's do it.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 12 and open a work session on the same memorial.
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair Lim.
Are we in a work session, right?
We are in a work session.
Okay, I'd like to move it, House HJM 12, to the floor with the two pass recommendations.
Vice Chair Lim moves House Joint Memorial 12 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? I'm not seeing any. On the question, Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Dowell?
Aye.
Representative Broad?
Aye.
Representative Obie?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lynn?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Witt?
Aye. House Joint Memorial 12, having received the necessary majority, is sent to the House floor. Is there any reason why this shouldn't be sent, placed on the consent calendar?
I'm not going to dispute that it should be on the, but in talking with my colleague here, right now the only weapon we seem to have in Oregon is the ability to talk about this issue. And if we have an opportunity to talk about this on the House floor, and what this committee went through, I think we should exercise that opportunity and again raise the flag that something's got to be done.
And I would like to carry this if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and with that, Vice Chair Riley will carry the bill. We will, and I will close the work session on that memorial. Thank you very much, committee members. I appreciate that. Vice Chair Riley, appreciate your carrying the bill.
Thank you.
Will Representative Riley be carrying that to Washington, too?
Yeah. Mr. Riley goes to Washington. I don't think so.
Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3066. And, Ellen, if you would please remind us what this bill does.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 3066 establishes the City of Hillsborough Downtown Parking Facility Fund. You should have dash one amendments to 3066 in your folders. The effect of the committee amendments are simply that the prerequisites for the city obtaining the bonds, as opposed to being listed separately in the statute, are now have just been moved to a contract requirement between the city and the state, and the amendments add to the legislative findings.
Thank you very much. And we have dash one amendments, which I'm led to understand. Jack Isselman, are you? Where's Jack? There he is. Are you willing to discuss for us the amendments? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Isselman of Tonkin Torp. I appear today on behalf of the City of Hillsborough and present to you for your approval House Bill 3066, the Dash 1 Amendments. As explained by the committee administrator, these Dash 1 Amendments are largely technical changes. Department of Administrative Services was added at the request of the Treasurer's Office as a necessary prerequisite to administration of an eventual bond sale. We also, as the committee administrator indicated, added to the legislative findings, and finally, we added to the requisites for the city to receive the state resources so that the state bonding capacity is utilized last in this project, and essentially the state money is the last money received once the city has procured private and other federal funds. As I mentioned previously in my testimony, the city has put up its funds of $1.6 million. Those are appropriated to the total cost of this project of roughly $16 million. And with that, I can take any questions.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Isselman. It's my understanding that even the state's money going last, if it is not all required to finish this project, that it won't be utilized, that all of it won't be utilized. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, that's correct. At on page 2, line 11 of the amendments, section 3, subsection A, subsection C, there is a clause in there that will require the city to refund the difference to this fund if the expenditure of state and local monies is less than $11.6 million. That reflects the $10 million that we're asking for in bonding capacity from the state and $1.6 million of local funds. So if funds are expended less than that amount, or over that amount, the money comes back to the state, to the fund. reappropriation of the general fund.
Representative Dolan.
On the other side of the coin, with a public project of this nature, the likelihood of cost overrun is there. Who will pick up the slack if this project has a cost overrun?
Representative Donald Chairwitt, the intent of the project managers, and we have a representative of Pacific University in the audience today. I don't want to speak for the university.
It's my understanding that even the state's money going last, if it is not all required to finish this project, that it won't be utilized, all of it won't be utilized. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative Riley, that's correct. At on page 2, line 11 of the amendments, section 3, subsection A, subsection C, there is a clause in there that will require the city to refund the difference to this fund if the expenditure of state and local monies is less than $11.6 million. That reflects the $10 million that we are asking for in bonding capacity from the state and $1.6 million of local funds. So if funds are expended less than that amount, or over that amount, the money comes back to the state, to the fund, for reappropriation to the general fund.
Representative Dolan.
On the other side of the coin, with a public project of this nature, the likelihood of cost overrun is there. Who will pick up the slack if this project has a cost overrun?
Representative Dallum Chairwitt, the intent of the project managers, and we have a representative of Pacific University in the audience today, so I don't want to speak for the university, but the intent is that any cost overruns would be covered privately through private donation, presumably through the university or other resources.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Last time I raised the issue concerning some parking lot charges. I understand in Hillsborough area no parking lot has been charged on the street. And then can you explain that why in the future it shouldn't be?
Vice Chair Lim, Chair with members of the committee, we had an opportunity to visit the Vice Chair in his office with Mayor Tom Hughes of the City of Hillsborough. What we explained to Vice Chair Lim, and what I'd like the full committee to be aware of, is once we add this capacity to downtown Hillsborough, the plan is to take a broad view of our downtown infrastructure needs broadly, including parking, and evaluate whether or not it makes sense to establish a downtown parking district where we would charge for parking across the downtown area. As we've discussed in previous testimony before this committee, as phase two of this project comes online and is built out, we're expecting 1,500 new visitors per day potentially downtown. That would be a significant increase in the amount of downtown population and traffic during the day, and will require the city to take a look at a range of infrastructure needs, including parking, and bringing in an element of charging for parking across the city so that those resources can be maintained.
Okay. One more question, please. Is the $10 million of the state the funding is a large amount of money. Do you know in the past the state funded any parking project in a statewide in the Portland in the past?
Vice Chair Lim, Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm not aware of any funding of this kind for a parking facility previously, but We have not researched that particular issue. We are certainly aware of funding of this nature going toward the type of economic development infrastructure that we believe this project brings forward, where you have the potential to catalyze $136 million of private funds. We're very familiar with projects that, frankly, have catalyzed less in terms of private investment compared to leverage of the state investment. So in that nature, we think this project is very similar. Whether or not a project of this kind directly tied to a parking facility has been brought before the legislature previously, I'm not aware of that.
Mr. Chair, I just want to express my concern when we open a gate, one door, eventually there will be many more doors asking for state fund for parking structure, not only Hillsborough, but in Portland, even Gresham, any other places. I'm not sure whether the state can sustain doing that in the future. I just want to, in the record, express my concerns about that.
Vice Chair Lim, Chair Witt, if I could just respond to that very briefly. I do want to underscore the Mayor's testimony before this committee earlier. Infrastructure needs across the state are a very emergent problem. And we are very supportive of the Economic Development Department's efforts to recapitalize its capital loan and grant funds, and recognize that communities across the state have these infrastructure needs. And we do believe that this is a project of a very unique nature that contributes broadly to workforce and economic development across the state, which is why we bring it forward to your committee. But we are certainly aware of your concern and share that as well.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just as a comment to Vice Chair Lim about the potential for opening the floodgates to more parking garages, and my comment would be if any place, any project in the state can show the economic development that will occur because of a parking garage that this one can, I think we should approve them.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Holdy.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 3066.
Representative Holby, I'd ask you to withdraw that for a moment while we have some additional questions.
Okay.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I withdraw it.
Thank you. Representative Gerard.
I think I follow with Representative Lim's concern, and I voice this, and I think this is a wonderful project. My concern is there's a limited amount of money, and I have to look out for my own district and wooden water pipes, as I discussed before, and it comes down to a question of who gets what. And this is a booming area right now, and I am a little bit reluctant to throw more money in a booming area when we have depressed areas that are not getting enough money. So I wanted to allow you a chance to address that.
Representative Gerard, Chair Witt, members of the committee, as we've testified previously, we believe one of the real benefits of this investment is the fact that we will be putting healthcare practitioners in clinics and hopefully ultimately in practice in rural and distressed communities throughout the state. Again, there's a representative of Pacific University here who can speak more to that, but several of these programs, occupational therapy, optometry, and physical therapy, are the only programs of the type offered in the state. This is a workforce pipeline for all of the Northwest and the far reaches of Oregon. We spoke with Rep. Dallum. He related an experience where he once housed, I think, an optometry graduate of Pacific out in the Dalles. So Pacific has a statewide commitment. So I do think this has a direct tie to investment and promotion of communities across the state of Oregon, and that's why we bring the project forward. Again, as the mayor testified, We wish we had a different piece of infrastructure we could offer up to the committee, but the reality is, given our situation in an urbanized downtown area, this is the piece of infrastructure that really has the most critical need for the project to go forward, and that's why we've brought it forward.
Thank you. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill has a subsequent to Ways and Means.
It does.
Okay, so the fact that we have a blank in the Dash 1 amendments doesn't matter. It's the kind of blank that they're supposed to fill in anyway.
That's correct, yes.
Thank you. Okay, that answers my question.
Mr. Chairman, did you have something to share?
Yes, I'd like to, before we adopt the, I believe it's the Dash 1 amendment, I support this project. This good project. It's music. And then, as I mentioned, Hillsborough area is a mecca of the electronic and high-tech industry. And it's good for the university over there continually growing. And at the same time, one concern I have is $10 million. It's my concern. Our body is the policy body that we can decide the policy, but not the amount. And my proposal is that we eliminate $10 million in a blank, let it work it out, the ways and means, how much it might be. And so that's my proposal, Mr. Chair. Why I support this project, putting the $10 million from our policy body of this country, I don't feel quite comfortable if we leave it blank and let it work it out. It could be $1 million, $1 million, and it's up to the Ways and Means to make a final decision. That is my just the move and proposal.
Thank you, Vice Chair Lim. Representative Colby, I think it's before we blow the transmission on this thing, that time to dump the clutch on that amendment.
we can do this a conception, how you call it?
Conceptual
amendment. This is simply removing this just $10 million. But at the same time, Mr. Chair, India $16 million on the page 2, line 20, is included $10 million in it, right?
Yes.
Yes. So, I'm asking, not eliminating all of it, simply $10 million. But we are also suggesting $16 million in it. Somehow, we are that somehow owing to it. At the same time, we are not pushing really hard the $10 million. That's it, you know.
Vice Chair Lim, Chair Witt, members of the committee, I think the city, I have not had a chance to confer with my client, but understands the nature of your conceptual amendments, I think, and that would be fine, given that, you know, we open a new round of this in Ways and Means in any event. I would suggest, however, if we are going to put a blank in for the amount of the allocation, that we also put a blank in for the amount that we'll have to pay back if we have cost savings on the project, because those two numbers were tied when we put them in.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind folks that this is not general fund money we're talking about. This is lottery bonds, and it does go to Ways and Means, and whether we put this amendment in or not for $10 million, they're going to decide how much. And while I agree with Vice Chair Lim that's a, you know, would be an okay conceptual, I think it's not needed, because I see Representative Barnett nodding his head with me, because the Ways and Means is going to make that decision whatever number we put in. So I would like us to just go ahead with this amendment. In fact, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendment to this bill.
Vice Chair Riley moves the
adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3066. Discussion on that motion. Yes, Representative Barnard.
Thank you. I would only add one comment to Chair Riley's comment, which I completely agree with, and that is that the project came forward with the understanding that it was that the amount of money that the state needed to put up was $10 million. And we ought to send to the Ways and Means Committee a clear statement of the nature of the transaction. And that means leaving that number in place. The blank that we have in there is the number that we really can't calculate here because that is their job. Certainly, if the Ways and Means Committee decided that they wanted to fund this project at a lower amount, they could expeditiously amend the numbers without any problem.
Mr. Chair, I just want to mention I support the project, but I will continue to oppose that the putting the $10 million in it. So I just want to clear myself on the point.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative.
I would like to kind of echo the same that Representative Lynn did. I think this is a wonderful project, and especially it's involving higher ed and that sort of thing. But there's a limited amount of money in lottery. I am concerned that it's going to impact negatively on my district and other rural districts, and I'll be opposing this as well. Okay. Thank you very much for your comments, Representative Joe and Representative Dome.
Yes, Chair, I have a laundry list of things that I'm very concerned about funding education, community colleges, and universities. To the point that I lobbied my wife this morning. I'll lobby anybody that'll sit down and listen to me. Judges were moving to the 50th place in the nation for what we pay our judges. Public safety, we're talking about 24/7 coverage on the highway. Health, we're looking at healthy kids. But I know the value of Pacific. The co-chair's budget has explained to us that lottery bonds, there is a ceiling and it's coming. Our ability to repay them, we cannot dip into those too long. So I'm going to give you a courtesy vote because I want to see how Ways and Means, who's a black hole to me, them and the other side of the building, I never know what those people are for. If they can tuck all of this in and take care of education, the judicial, and public safety, I'll give you a courtesy. I'm not sure I'll see this as a clear shot on the floor, but those priorities are far more important to me than this one. But in order to give Ways and Means a chance to balance it, I will give you a courtesy vote.
So, I just want to...
Please,
I mean, what is your choice? Choice is... it seems to me to your vote, sending to Ways and Means, give them some negative impact on it, or is it better with the I vote to take out the $10 million? It's your choice, Vice Chair.
No pressure, Vice Chair.
No pressure at all. The problem is that we really don't have the time to deal with another amendment.
Mr. Chair, we can just make a conceptual change, just one word, that we can do it.
I'm going to put us in recess here momentarily while we have a little sidebar discussion. Before to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3066.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Riley.
I move a conceptual amendment to the amendment.
Okay.
Which will remove the $10 million figure and put a blank in that spot, and also the repayment amount of 11.6, I believe it is.
Yeah.
And put a blank in that spot as well.
Vice Chair Riley has moved a conceptual amendment to the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3066. On page 2, line 13 and 14, $11.6 million would be replaced with a blank. On line 16, $10 million would be replaced with a blank. On discussion on the motion. I'm not seeing any. Is there any objection to adopting the amendment to the amendment?
Chair, wait, if I could just interject, it's a very small point. I think the conceptual amendment should include a dollar sign and a blank to be consistent with the
$10 million.
Yeah, just a dollar sign and a blank rather than a blank.
Rather than the blank. Okay, I see. All right, thank you.
Yeah, we're only replacing the numbers, not the dollar sign.
Okay.
That's what I did.
Sorry.
Well, thank you for the clarification. Any objections to adopting that amendment to the amendment? So adopted. To the original amendment? Further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendment as amended to House Bill 3066? Not seeing any. It is adopted.
Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Riley.
I move House Bill 3066 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and a subsequent to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Riley moves House Bill 3066 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation with a subsequent to Joint Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
I just want to thank the Vice Chair Riley for making a good compromise. I think it's much better with the all I vote to the Ways and Means. And so
I just want to mention
that we have full support of this appeal.
Thank you very, very much.
And thank you, Chair, Vice Chair Lim.
I certainly appreciate the help and cooperation of both of our co-chairs. On the question, Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Courtesy aye.
Representative Drott?
Courtesy aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye. Courtesy aye.
Vice Chair Lynn?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
A very strong aye, thank you.
Aye. House Bill 3066, having received the necessary majority, is moved to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Thank you very much. And I'm going to close the work session on that bill. Folks, mindful of the floor session today, we're going to have to proceed along here. Next up, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3181. Ellen, if you'd please remind us what this bill does.
Thank you, Chair Whip, members of the committee. House Bill 3181 gives child care providers the right to collectively bargain with the state of Oregon, and it declares an emergency. I believe that Mr. Kessner has amendments to the bill. Is that correct? So there are Dash 1 amendments. When you look in your folders, you'll see that there are some proposed conceptual amendments, and that was simply because we didn't think that the actual amendments would be ready this morning, but they are.
Okay.
So you should have the proposed amendments to House Bill 3181, and all that does is it changes the wording from Department of Human Services and Employment Department to the State of Oregon as the folks on whose behalf the Department of Administrative Services can bargain with the union. It adds a reference to employer being the employer of record, and it adds an emergency clause.
Committee members, if you'd like a moment to review your file.
Yeah.
I should probably add, this bill did not come with a subsequent referral from the Speaker's office, and we do not yet have a fiscal statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Thank you, Owen.
What does that mean?
Representative Barnhart, we were left wondering exactly what I was wondering.
I'm not trying to hide the ball. I just, I think sometimes there's the potential for some bills to, subsequent to being passed out of committee, you get a fiscal back that indicates there might be some sort of fiscal impact. And I know there's a companion bill in the Senate, and it too has not received a fiscal impact. So I thought I would just bring it to your attention that this might be one that ends up having a fiscal, but I don't know that.
Representative Dahl?
Mr. Chair, I don't see how it cannot have an impact. As we had testimony and we looked at the wages these people were paid, and I'm not being at all facetious, if we doubled their wages, I know the impact on the wrong scale of things wouldn't be much, but it would be an impact on the state budget. Do we at least have a referral to that place in the middle of the earth, Ways and Means?
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Although I appreciate the potential of the future causing fiscal impacts, I guess I kind of feel like this bill is providing a right to collectively bargain with the state of Oregon. It doesn't necessarily mean that the collective bargaining process could go a direction that saves the state money, or it could go the direction of costing the state money, or it could end up the same. So I don't think this bill necessarily has a fiscal impact, and I don't know that the collective bargaining process causes directly a fiscal impact. The contract that comes out of that process may in fact cause a fiscal impact, but I don't think the bill itself does. So I just wanted to add that.
Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in fact, there's absolutely no way to know what the salary and benefits of these folks is going to be with or without collective bargaining, and even frankly, if you double the income of all these folks, the impact would be
$2
would be less than what we consider a major impact. So I that's all I have to say on that one.
I simply wanted to agree with Representative Holby's remark. This bill has a very minimal impact because the cost would be administrative. That is the effort necessary to recognize the union. The potential cost of the change in the law down the road is not calculable at this stage. And one of the restraints on any effect is, of course, the availability of funds to pay it.
Right.
So it isn't at all. I mean, the bill itself has obviously minimal fiscal impact, I think, because we're talking about a small amount of administrative effort to comply with it. The question of whether or not the bill has a long-term fiscal impact because of the change in the law is an entirely different question. I don't know how we'd calculate that, but then I don't know how we would calculate what the fiscal impact would be of the simple passage of time and the development of the state budget when it comes to this area anyway, whether this bill passed or not. In that sense, I agree completely with Representative Holder's remarks.
Representative Bone, a long time ago, a bill was passed that said teachers had the right to negotiate wages, hours, and conditions of employment. I'm sure that the same conversation was held.
I know that being a teacher and organizing our local, that meant more money to me. That's where I was going with it. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that now that I had the right, things were going to improve. And improvement meant more pay for the members of my union. So I'm when we see the conditions that and the pay that these people are paid, I don't want to stand in the way, but to say there's no financial impact, I really have to argue with you, because being on the other end of this legislation a long time ago, it held out hope to me, and I knew what it meant. And it was a physical impact on schools.
Representative Barnhart.
Let me try again, because I think the question was, does this bill require a fiscal impact statement? And I think the answer is no, for the reasons I've given.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
I'd like to cut this short, move the dash.
There's absolutely no way to know what the salary and benefits of these folks is going to be with or without collective bargaining. And even frankly, if you double the income of all these folks, the impact would be
$2.
Would be less than what we consider a major impact. So I that's all I have to say.
I simply wanted to agree with Representative Holvey's remark. This bill has a very minimal impact because the cost would be administrative. That is the effort necessary to recognize a union. The potential cost of the change in the law down the road is not calculable at this stage. And one of the restraints on any effect is, of course, the availability of funds to pay it. So it isn't at all. I mean, the bill itself has obviously minimal fiscal impact, I think, because we're talking about a small amount of administrative effort to comply with it. The question of whether or not the bill has a long-term fiscal impact because of the change in the law is an entirely different question. I don't know how we'd calculate that, but then I don't know how we would calculate what the fiscal impact would be of the simple passage of time and the development of the state budget when it comes to this area anyway, whether this bill passed or not. Right? In that sense, I agree completely with Representative Holder's remarks.
Representative Bone.
A long time ago, a bill was passed that said teachers had the right to negotiate wages, hours, and conditions of employment. I'm sure that this same conversation was held. I know that being a teacher and organizing our local, that meant more money to me. That's where I was going with it. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that now that I had the right, things were going to improve. And improvement meant more pay for the members of my union. So I'm when we see the conditions that and the pay that these people are paid, I don't want to stand in the way, but to say there's no financial impact, I really have to argue with you, because being on the other end of this legislation a long time ago, it held out hope to me, and I knew what it meant. And it was a physical impact on schools.
Representative Barnhart.
Let me try again, because I think the question was, does this bill require a fiscal impact statement? And I think the answer is no, for the reasons I've given.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
I'd like to cut this short, move the dash one amendments.
I know it.
Representative,
I'll withdraw it.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Representative Gerard. I would love nothing more than for you to have made that. I do feel, as the chair of the committee, however, some obligation
since the issue has been raised, to have legislative fiscal describe for us any potential fiscal impact at this point.
Okay.
And Ellen's gone to bring someone from their office here to discuss that with us. So in the interim, do either of the representatives from SEIU or AFSCME have anything that they would like to add that might clarify this for us while we're awaiting legislative fiscal? Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And in regard to the issue of the fiscal impact, there's a couple different things that that we've looked at. One is the issue that Representative Dallum raised regarding the cost of the negotiations. But that's something that is unknowable at this point. In 2000, when there was a ballot measure granting home care workers the right to bargain collectively, the fiscal impact process that one goes through during the ballot measure process found that you couldn't determine the amount in the contract, and so there's a precedent that that's something that will come up down the road and go through the entire Ways and Means process in the Human Services budget for child care providers. On the other question in terms of administrative costs is the cost of some of the technical costs around say computer programming, things like that. And again, with the in the instance of the home care providers, that was a subject of collective bargaining. In fact, our union representing the home care workers agreed to pick up some of that cost. We aren't in the position yet to agree that we'll pick up that cost, but we are in the position to agree we'll bargain collectively, bargain over that cost. So we feel that the fiscal impact should be minimal in this setting.
Thank you, Arthur. Janice?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janice O'Malley, and I'm here representing AFSCME Child Care Providers, Local 132. And I'd like to piggyback on what Arthur had mentioned, that as a right to collectively bargain, there shouldn't be a fiscal impact. What we negotiated this past summer was for the chance for our providers to reach the 75th percentile of the market rate, and that's reflected in the governor's budget. The co-chairs did not bring us to that level, and if that is not able to happen, we go back to negotiations. And so we understand that, you know, we can come to an agreement in a contract, but if the legislature doesn't approve the funds to do that, then we don't have it.
Right. Plain and
simple.
Chair, but that would be a separate part of the budget process,
right.
Separate from this bill.
Certainly. Thank you both. Any questions?
We have a minute. Yeah. This process then is different in that the collective bargaining is done with the association and the governor's office when the budget process starts. It sounded like we're not negotiating on an individual basis the entire SEIU or whatever the organization is negotiating with some representative from the state.
Chair, Representative Dallum, I believe that the unions would negotiate with a representative of the state, presumably the Department of Administrative Services, on behalf of the state of Oregon as the bill has been amended. And so that's the way the process would work, similar to other contract negotiations with other workers.
I'm not seeing anything further. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to
momentarily recess the hearing, or work session, rather. Everyone can stand at ease while we await someone from Legislative Fiscal. Record. The committee was back on the record. The committee was discussing House Bill 3181 and looking at moving towards the adoption of the amendments. A question came up about the potential fiscal impact on the bill. This is a relatively new arena in terms of collective bargaining. There are not a whole lot of previous examples. And at this point, Legislative Fiscal, I think, would benefit from an opportunity to weigh other experiences with collective bargaining to be able to come up with a fiscal. It appears that there may be a fiscal. It also has the appearance that it may likely be relatively small, but no one can say for certain at this time. And because of that uncertainty, I would like this to be done and done right. I'm going to hold over this work session until Monday night. With that, sorry, folks. And,
are you announcing a meeting for Monday night?
I'm getting there.
I can suddenly see a lot of value in the way they are.
And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3181.
We just got the work to go back in and pass it.
Well, yes, and I'm sure, and I do appreciate Representative Gerard's earlier step, but I also feel that the process is very important, and I want the citizens of the state of Oregon to feel absolutely comfortable with that we've done our best work possible. And so I thank all of you. It does mean, committee members, that we, our committee, will have to have a meeting Monday night. We've had some late-breaking developments on House Bill 2981. There was a miscommunication between a couple parties of interest. That, too, is going to mean that bill will more than likely be held over until Monday night as well. With that, Representative Holvey, can we do your bill in 20 minutes and make it to the House floor?
I certainly hope.
10:30.
Oh, we're in good shape, then, Representative Holvey. Can you do it in 21 minutes?
We have caucus at 10
o'clock.
10 o'clock caucus? Okay. Representative Holvey is going to make this one a quick one.
I think so, Mr. Chair.
Are you opening a work session?
I'm going to hear momentarily.
Which dashes are we looking at?
Hold on. Let me just catch up with where we're at here. I've got to get to the bill file. Okay. With that, I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2618. Representative Holvey, did you want to go first? Or do you have other guests? Or?
Mr. Chair, I was going to go down first.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I would like to have Sean Brand from Legislative Council, who's been entertained the whole morning by our committee, come forward as well, just Sean? Simply to go through this bill real briefly.
Okay.
I am... have gone through, as you see, a lot of different amendments on this, trying to address some of the concerns that were voiced to me over this bill. And the current -4 amendment is what I'm proposing to this committee. It does raise the threshold price up to $750,000 before a public agency has to require the contractors and subcontractors on their projects are approved training agents with apprenticeship programs. As well, in the bill, just summarily, it just states for those projects over $750,000 that they also have a requirement to make sure that 15% of the hours that are worked on that project in apprenticeable trades be performed by apprentices. And if I just remind the committee on that topic, you know, we have identified construction as being a high demand and high wage area in this state, and with the looming train wreck, as the chair has referred to it, in many other industries, this industry is also facing that train wreck of not having an adequate workforce for the future construction projects that are slated in the state of Oregon and across the Northwest. This is a huge issue for our economy. I believe that if the projects and our infrastructure are held up, are not done in a quality way, and are not on time, it's going to be a tremendous drag on our economy. And along with Representative Dallum's bill and also the Skill Up bill, trying to put some focus on vocational and the skilled trades is, I think, vital to the state of Oregon and our economy. So this bill is basically meant to make sure that as public agencies that we set the standard and make a commitment to training a future workforce, because it is in our best interest as well as the interest of the whole Northwest to make sure we have a commitment to providing a future workforce in this industry. And I will note that an ODOT representative and a Boley representative from the Apprenticeship and Training Division are also here to comment or offer any answers to questions that we may not be able to answer specifically. The bill does also exempt ODOT from this bill for 5 years in regards to the 15% requirement, because they have their own program that's already in place that's trying to address this issue, but in a slightly different way. And I believe that they're okay with this bill, but I'll let them speak for themselves. And perhaps if the committee wishes, Sean Brennan is here, if you want him to go through the amendments or specifically that's a
thank you, Representative. I appreciate that very much. Shonda, could you give us a relatively brief overview of what the amendments do?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Sean Brennan from Legislative Counsel's Office. Briefly speaking, what the bill does is essentially three things. It sets up a requirement that the public agencies entering into public works contracts need to make sure that and verify that the contractors and subcontractors are approved training agents. It does that on the first section on page one, with the requirement that there be in a contract that exceeds a price of $750,000, a verification that every employer, including subcontractors, be an approved training agent, as that's defined in Chapter 660. Also, the bill does apply a 15% requirement for employment of apprentices on projects of that size, and it does that on Section 6, which you'll find on page 5 of the amendments. That sets out the 15% requirements. The total hours worked on any public works project by workers in apprenticeable occupations. And in there, there's also a escape clause, so to speak, for contractors or subcontractors who, for one reason or another, are not able to get the number of apprentices that are necessary to fulfill that requirement. They can apply to the contracting agency and to Boley to get an adjustment to that percentage for that particular project. Again, they need to demonstrate that, in fact, there are not sufficient apprentices available for their apprenticeable occupations in order to do that. The commissioner then makes a verification and can make an adjustment in the percentage rate if necessary. And there are other provisions of this that are more or less modeled on the prevailing wage range of statutes, which is where this is eventually going to be folded in, the majority of it. and those include the verification procedures that are available for the certified payroll statements. We'll be adding in that a requirement that the contractors would add apprenticeship verification number, or apprentice, I can't remember the exact term of that.
Registration
number, thank you. The contract is registered with the contracting agency with Boley. That registration number will appear on certified payroll statements the contractors are required to submit monthly to the contracting agency. Those are public records, and as such, the folks who have an interest in making sure that the percentage rate is actually met can look at those statements and verify that that requirement is being met and ask for enforcement if, in fact, it is not. There's an enforcement provision for Boley to take a look at this to make sure that, in fact, the percentage minimum percentage requirement is being met. They have investigative powers available to do that. And also, there is a civil penalty provision that allows Boley to go back after, in fact, the project may be complete and do a separate enforcement action to exact a civil penalty against contractors or subcontractors who don't actually meet this requirement. It can be a $5,000 penalty for a violation in toto, that is, after the project is complete, and there's a determination that, in fact, the contractor or subcontractor did not meet the requirement. There's a $5,000 penalty for that entire violation. There's also a separate penalty that is calculated on the basis of the number of hours they failed to work through apprentices. There's a 15% requirement. If they go under that 15% requirement, the calculation is essentially $20 an hour for every hour worked that they should have worked with apprentices that, in fact, they did not. And that provision is actually contained, I think, in, let's see.
Section 9.
Section 9. Thank you very much. And that's on page 10 of your amendments. And that's contained in subsection 1, which is the general $5,000 civil penalty provision for violation of prevailing wage statutes. We're adding that in and also keeping on top of that a separate cost in subsection 2, which is, again, a $20 per hour calculation based on the 15%. The other requirements...
Excuse me if I may.
Yes, sir.
On that provision. This is essentially a liquidated damages statement.
Essentially, that's correct.
Well, I mean, there's no less than contained in it, or there's no not exceeding language in this section.
That's correct.
It's just an amount.
Chairwitt, Representative Barnhart, yes, that is correct. It is an amount. It's it's variable depending on the degree to which the contractor did not meet the requirement, however.
Right.
So
right.
It would be a calculation after the fact made on the basis of investigation.
Representative Dahlem.
Yes, we just passed a bill that would give Boley subpoena power. Now we've given them power to go in the door of the contractor's business. Is this normal and customary, or does this power to go in the door exceed other regulatory agencies?
Representative Witt, Representative Dahlem, no, it doesn't really exceed other regulatory agencies. Most agencies have some ability to do investigative enforcement of one sort or another in order to make sure that the laws that are subject to of the folks that they are regulating, that they in fact are able to enforce those laws. Boley has some ability to do subpoena power, but that is not unusual among certain agencies who can go and issue subpoenas or make investigative demands of various sorts.
I'm thinking of the Department of Health. They have to go in the restaurant. Here we have, I'm not sure I understand this, the information on wages, hours reported are public record. Why are we going, that's what we're after, isn't it? Why are we going in the door?
Chair Witt, Representative Dahlem, there's a couple of instances there. The basic enforcement model that is here in the prevailing wage statute and elsewhere in state law as well depends on a couple of things. The agency in question here, Boley, has two methods by which they could possibly do the enforcement necessary for both the prevailing wage statutes and this new requirement. One of which is that they have the power to go in and inspect the records of the contractors and subcontractors and make sure that they, in fact, are complying with state law as this is now drafted. And that's not, again, unusual for most regulatory agencies to have some power to go and inspect the records of the folks that they're regulating to do that. The second is that here we have a report that's required to be made, certified wage statements are required to be made to the contracting agency. Those are not necessarily passed on to BOLI directly, at least not immediately. And the reason for that is that there is likely to be too big a fiscal impact on BOLI and their own staff in order to be reviewing these contracts constantly and making sure that the requirements are being met. This is actually a more somewhat passive regulatory posture whereby they will respond to complaints, and therefore the records are public, and those people who have an interest in making sure that this is in fact enforced, I have the ability to go in and make a complaint based on records that are public.
So the in the door comes from reasonable suspicion of violation or a reasonable expectation that something has to be fixed.
Representative Witt to Representative Dallum, that's correct. And it's a permissive power that's given to the commissioner. The commissioner can do this. It's not the commissioner is not required to actually make these investigations, and they through other means can actually establish the circumstances in which they would do something like that.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, I might add, and you know, you probably already know this, but this is only in regards to public contracts and how our public agencies are spending their money through public contracts. This is, you know, strictly within the prevailing wage and public contracting laws.
No.
Thank you. That covers it.
Thank you very much. Yes. No. Vice Chair Lim, thank you.
Thank you. And maybe we heard this before. Maybe I forgot. The $750,000 threshold. What's the public works under the category of what percentage of the total public works under the $750,000? Is 10%, 5%, or any ideas?
I might call up Steve Sims. He might have a better answer for that. This bill last session came forward as $150,000. I put it forward this session at $350,000, and as my amendments came, I ended up at $750,000 to basically solve some of the concerns from some of our smaller agencies around being able to have small pieces of the contracts comply with apprenticeship ratios. And so I think, you know, the amount of contracts that are above or below the $750,000 amount, although might be good information, I don't know that it's really relevant to the purpose of this bill, which is basically to make sure that a portion of our workforce and a portion of our hours that are being contracted for by public agencies is being performed by apprentices to basically put into law our commitment to training a future workforce. Mm-hmm. So whether or not it's above 750 or below 750, the percentage of work, I just don't know. I mean, it's good information, but I don't know if it's really relevant.
And since I'm asking, can I ask one more
Please
question?
Please do.
And as I read the bill on the dash four amendment on page 19, and including contractors and any subcontractors, and in my opinion, contractors is fine, but why do we include the subcontractors? Already, contractor is responsible, and then. Maybe contractors might have employee one place here, one place over there. One place have 20% apprentices. Maybe one place might have 5%. So the combined together could be a 15%. But when we're requiring subcontractors, also same like exactly subcontractors and contractors together, it doesn't make any sense to me. I'm wondering, can you give me some reasonable explanation for that?
Well, I guess I'll take a stab at that. Is that the work's being, no matter who the work's being performed by, the contractor or the subcontractor, the idea is that the the amount of hours that are being performed on the project, the total hours by people or workers in that apprenticeable trades, that when the project's done, that 15% of those hours have been worked by apprentices. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's a subcontractor or a general contractor. The idea is that the total hours work are done by apprentices. So it would have to apply to both subcontractors because, frankly, they're probably performing the majority of the work that's being done. So it does need to apply to all. And maybe somebody can help me understand.
Language is not quite clear. Is that these contractors and subcontractors, they are all responsible 15%, 15%, 15% instead of all aggregated together.
Chair, they are aggregated together, I believe, in this.
But it doesn't say that.
Chair Witt, Representative Lim, in fact, it does say that with regard to the 15% requirement. 50% requirement can be met by either the subcontractor or the general contractor or both. And that's actually in the section 6 that actually talks about that. There's a sentence at the end of the first section that talks about how either of the two parties could meet that requirement.
What line is it?
24. Starting on line 24 on page 5.
On page 5?
Yes, that's correct. And Representative Lim, it says either the contractor or the subcontractor may meet the requirement set forth in this subsection, that is the 15% requirement, except that the subcontractor shall independently meet the requirement in performing the work on any subcontract for which the subcontract price exceeds $750,000. And that's again to the subcontract is in the multi, or if the contract is in the multi-millions of dollars and each subcontract in that is, or some subcontract under the $750,000.
Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, how about the questions of threshold? What percentage of the public works under the $750,000?
Chair Witt, Representative Lynn Stevens Sims with the Apprenticeship and Training Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Lynn, I don't have the exact figure at $750,000. When this bill was first introduced in February, that same question was asked, and I think at that time we were at a $350,000 limit.
Yes.
And I did provide to the committee information about what number of bills were at $350,000. Unfortunately, I did not bring that information with me. I do know that in fiscal year 2003-05, a total of 2,826 contracts, public contracts, were let in excess of $25,000. And the statistics I did bring with me indicate that of that, 1,064 of them exceeded $250,000. So a relatively less than half exceeded that limit. I think if we were to run the numbers again at $750,000, we would find an even smaller percentage. So I would not be surprised if we were talking about less than half of the public contracts issued in the state.
Okay.
But I don't have those specific figures with me. I would be happy to have our staff run them for you, though.
Yes, if you could, I would appreciate it.
Certainly.
Thank you, Steve. We appreciate that offer.
Trevor, can I ask a question before we go?
I've got several questions, and I know that several of you need to go to caucus. Representative Riley, can you be quick?
My question was answered. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Dahlem, can you...
I want to go back to get on line again, because I think I pushed us away from where we want to be. The original intent of the bill is to provide apprentices so that we may remain viable and productive in the construction trades. The authority that is given to Boley and authorized in this law is no greater than the authority Boley would have in any other, if they were doing Little Bacon Davis investigation. So, and when we go to the aggregate contract, we're looking at about half of them. So I think, and then I did have one other question, and I think Representative Holby has taken care of this. The small counties are grouped together. Their contractors are not excluded. They would be able to borrow apprenticeship programs, my term, from adjacent counties. I think all the questions I have were taken care of.
Thank you very much, Representative Dahlem. Thank you, gentlemen. I certainly appreciate your input. And as our clock is winding down, we have 1 minute. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
I'll move the dash four.
Representative Barnhart moves the dash four amendments to House Bill 2618. Is there any discussion on that motion? I'm not hearing any. Is there any objection to adopting those amendments? I'm not seeing any. Dash four amendments are adopted to House Bill 2618.
Representative Holby. Or
Representative Holby.
Yes, Representative Holby. Mr. Chair, Representative Holby moves House Bill 2618 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Holby moves House Bill 2618 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? I'm not seeing any. On the question, Barry, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Dahlem? Aye.
Representative
Drush? No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lynn?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Wick?
Aye. House Bill 2618, having received the necessary majority, is moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Holby, will you carry that bill?
Certainly.
Thank you very much. And we close the work session on House Bill 2618. Any additional business to come before this committee? I'm not seeing any. We are adjourned.
Thank you. Real fast. You really can't.